those groups shifting among others to share whatever rumor or intelligence they'd garnered of Macaja Bland's fate. And then I looked down and saw a satchel not far from where Otha and Raymond had stood. On instinct, I reached for the satchel and carried it back into my tent, and when I opened it, I found a collection of newspapers detailing the saga of Macaja Bland and Lydia White. The first item told the tale, "Runaway Negroes Taken." The second confirmed that it was indeed the family of Otha White. My hands trembled as I thumbed through the third, "Thief of Negroes Returned to Alabama." And then finally a dispatch from an Indiana agent who wrote with great sorrow, communicating the news, "The body of Macaja Bland had that morning washed up on the shore, head stove in, hands bound behind him in chains." By then, I had been trained to package away misery, and so what I thought of in that moment was not Macaja Bland, but the simple task of getting those papers back to Raymond and Otha. I moved among the crowd. A few people, knowing my affiliation with the Philadelphia station, tried to stop me and ask what I might know. I ignored them and scanned among the tents for a clue as to where they might have taken Otha. I saw some of the agents of the Western Underground before a tent. One of them waved to me. "Here," he said. And then another parted the entrance for me, and walking in, I saw Otha seated there with Raymond. Otha was calmer now, though still smoldering. There were a few others whom I recognized as clearly senior within the loose leadership of the Underground. Harriet was there, and most shockingly, seated calmly, Corrine Quinn. There was not much time to weigh her presence. The conversation halted when I entered. "I am sorry," I said, walking over to Raymond, "but I thought you might need these." Raymond thanked me, and I took my leave, allowing the meeting to continue. I walked away from the camp, back toward the woods where I'd met Harriet a day before. I sat there, on that same boulder where Harriet had sat. Would that I could open a door right here in the woods, I thought, and pull the cotton fields of Alabama to the forests of New York. But I had nothing. A power was within me, but with no thought of how to access it or control it, I was lost. I returned and found the camp still in mourning. It was afternoon by then. I went to my tent and lay down. When I awoke, Otha was there seated in a chair next to me. Otha was a man of true feeling, but never wild in his passions or flagrant in his rages. I had never seen him as he was 2 days before in joy, nor as he was that morning in agony. "Otha," I said, I'm sorry. I don't even know what to say. I have never met Lydia or your children, but I have heard so much of them now that I feel them as family." "He was my brother, Hiram," Otha said. "Macaja Bland was not my blood, but he was so much my brother that he would die for me and mine. I am not young to any of this. I lived divided from my blood and made brothers wherever I lived and grieved every time we were divided. And we were always divided. But I have never, for an instant, shied away from connection, from love. I am sorry about my anger this morning. Raymond did not deserve it, and I am sorry you saw me as such. There's no need, Otha." He was silent for a few minutes. I said nothing, thinking that this was Otha's time. "I want to tell you a story about dreaming. I want to tell you specifically because I know you have struggled to see your place, struggled to touch that power they all say is in you. And if in this pain I can give something to you, that would well soothe me, too." I sat up in my pallet and listened. "I met my wife, Lydia, shortly after Lambert died. Lambert was older, stronger, and braver. He was my heart and my faith, and whenever I fell to despair, it was his unflagging belief that set me straight. And then to see him go under as he did, feeling that we would never get home, that God had truly indeed blighted us, a torrent of ugly came over me. I spent many nights in that very state that you saw me in this morning. Perhaps you know about this, a pain that reaches out and falls over your heart like night. I found my only balm was in the work, tasked. Though I was, my mind disappeared into my hands and I was soothed by the feels. The whites thought it was my great morality. They thought me gracious under the lash. But I hated them all, Hiram. For as sure as they had ripped me from the cradle, they had right well murdered my brother. In this state, I met Lydia. Perhaps, having been born into Alabama, she knew more about the weight and was better fitted to carry the great burden of a bonded life. I would rage and she would laugh. And soon enough, I found myself laughing along. And then I would be angry that she had diminished me to laughter, and I would laugh at the whole heap of the thing again. We were to be married, and I felt myself come back to the world. I was tired to something, you see. A few days before we were married, I came to see Lydia and found her back sore. She was well-liked and highly valued by all the quality and had never been condemned to a 7 and 9. She told me it was the boss's head man. He had been hot after her. She would not submit, and so he whipped her, claiming it done on account of her sassing him. When I heard that, my blood got up. I stood to leave without saying a word. She asked me what I planned to do. I said, "Kill him." "Don't you dare," Lydia said. "Why not?" I asked. "Because they will shoot you, and you knows it," she said. "I'll see that as it comes," I said, "but on my manhood, I gotta make this right." "Damn your manhood and every inch of you to hell if you touch one hair on that white man's head." "But you are mine, Lydia," I said, "and it's my duty to make you protected." "And you gonna protect me from under the ox too?" she asked. "I picked you for a reason. You done told me your story. I know that you have some notion of a place beyond this, Otha. It's got to be about more than this. It's got to be about more than anger, more than manhood. We got plans, me and you, and this is not our end. This is not how you and me die." Those words have never left me. You understand that, Hiram? I dream about them. "This is not our end," she say. "This is not how you and me die." She had taken the whip, but I was the one who was claiming to be wounded. I was supposed to love her, but all I was truly loving was my own regard. I know you can picture what horror we saw through our union, what horror at this very moment my Lydia, my children, must still see. But what I want you to see is what I am trying to now save, what sent Bland down under, and that is all that my Lydia and me built together. The jests that belong to only us, our children who are an honor upon us, a feeling so deep that it calls across this whole continent. Lydia saved my life, Hiram, and I will give anything to save hers. Makaja Bland knew all this, and they killed him for it. I grieve more than you know. Now he rose and held open the slit of the tent. "My Lydia will be free," he said. "This is not how we die. My Lydia will be free." Chapter 22. That next morning, it came the hour to decamp, and having gathered my affairs in my carpet bag, I wandered through the field and watched as this wondrous city of new ideas, of visions and liberated futures, of men and women which sprung up in the fields, fell back into nothing. I took a walk in the woods so as to enjoy the country air one last time before my descent into the smoke and filth of the city. When I returned, Raymond, Otha, and Harriet were all finishing their preparations. I saw Kessia nearby tightening the strap on a traveling piece. When she saw me, she put her hand to her mouth, walked over, pulled me close into a hug, and said, "I am so sorry, Hi. I am so deeply sorry." "I appreciate it," I said, "but no concern should be put upon me, not with Otha's family still lost." "I know, but I also know Makaja Bland was something to you. she said, and she gripped my arm tight, almost as a mother would a child. "Before you," I said. He was my closest connection back to the old place. Not that I would ever wish it, but it is truly something for him to leave me, just as you came. "It is," she said. "Maybe someone is watching for you." She smiled, and I felt a warmth between us. I had met Kesia only 3 days before, but already I had been drawn into her. She was the elder sister I had never thought to need, the plug in the hole that I had not even known was there. "Thank you, Kesia," I said. "I hope I shall see you soon. In fact, should you have some time, please put down a few lines for me." "I'd surely like to," she said. "I'm of the field, though, so I cannot say I can match eloquence with one such as you. Anyway, I shall be traveling to Philadelphia with you, me and Harriet. Mukaja Bland's going as he did has changed some things. Likely we will have to change, too." We embraced again. I reached down for her bag and carried it over to the coach and stowed it away. When I looked back, I saw that Raymond and Otha and Harriet had been joined by Corrine, and to my surprise, Hawkins and Amy. They were all in deep conversation and exchanging embraces and affectionate words for Otha. I had never seen them so soft with each other, but too, I had never seen the underground in mourning for one of its own. Corrine looked different. She had traded in the mask of Virginia, her hair flowed down to her shoulders, her ivory dress was plain. She wore neither powder nor rouge. When Hawkins spotted me, he nodded and gave, as much as was possible for him, a look of concern. We rode in a caravan of 3 coaches, Otha, Raymond, and I in the 1st coach, Corrine, Hawkins, and Amy in the 2nd, and finally Harriet, Kesia, and their driver, a young man conducted recently by Harriet, who swore himself to her. We bedded down that night at a small inn, about an hour's ride north of Manhattan Island. But sleep brought me not one measure of peace, for no sooner had I closed my eyes than I found myself lost in baneful nightmares, so that I was out in the water, out in the River Goose, bursting through the waves, and when I came up I saw all again May drowning before me, and I thought myself back there, and seeing already the blue light gathering around and knowing that the power was in me. I decided that this one would be different. But when I reached out, little May turned, and I saw it was not him, but Mukaja Bland. I awoke with a dreadful thought. I had created the passes. I had forged the letters of introduction. The fault for all of this must lie with me. I thought of Simpson. I thought of McKiernan. I thought of Chalmers. I ran through all the events of that night. I thought of the days following and all the practiced forgeries. And I remembered that it was sometimes perfection that gave up the house agent, that sometimes the passes were too good, too practiced, and aroused suspicion. It had been me. I was certain of it. I had killed Mukaja Bland. I had nearly killed Sophia. Perhaps I had doomed my mother somehow, and maybe that is why I could not remember. I felt my chest tighten. I could not breathe. I rose from my bed, dressed, and then stumbled outside. I sat on the back porch and bent over and breathed and breathed and breathed. Sitting up, I saw a garden in the back. It was still late evening. I walked through the garden, and as I approached, I heard familiar voices. Hawkins, Corrine, and Amy were there, all seated on a circle of benches, each of them smoking a cigar. We exchanged brief greetings, and I took my seat. By the moonlight, I saw Corrine inhale and then breathe out a long stream of smoke. And for a few long minutes, there was only the night music of insects. Then Corrine took it upon herself to speak what was in all of our minds. "He was an uncommon man," she said. "I knew him well, and liked him very much more. He was so uncommon. He found me all those years ago. He saved me. He showed me a world that I had not even glimpsed. I am not here without him." There was now more silence, and I watched as the faces around me alighted in the glow of the cigars. Guilt took hold of me, and I said, "He saved me, too. Saved me from Ryland, saved me from all those dumb notions of the swamps. Was he that first introduced me to books? I owe him more than could ever be known." Amy nodded and then reached into her pouch. She offered a cigar. I took it and nodded a thank you, then played with it between my fingers. Then I leaned into Hawkins, who struck up a light. I inhaled deep and said, "But I have learned, I tell you, I have learned some things."
"We all know, Hiram," said Hawkins. "Somebody say you headed down Maryland way, going down with Moses, as they say."
"If she still would have me."
"Oh, she will," Hawkins said. "Moses would not stop for Bland no more than Bland would have stopped for her. Might wait a few, but she is going. It is truly a terrible thing, but it is also just as he would want. An uncommon man, as you say, but he went just as every one of us would want."
I felt sick at that moment. I remembered my dream. I said, "And how was that?"
"Sure you want to know?" asked Amy.
She said this softly, and somehow this caused the whole blow to land with even greater effect. But I did want to know. As much as possible I did, and my guilt stripped me of all my guile, so that, as I inhaled this time, I began to cough and choke, and this gave Hawkins a great laugh, and then the whole party of them laughed together, and I watched them laughing until they all settled back into their silence. And when they had, I calmly said, "The papers. I did the papers. I believe it was me who got that man killed." This was the cause for more laughter, but this time only from Hawkins and Amy. "I did the papers," I said again. "No other way a man like Bland would have gotten caught, except by my hand."
"What do you mean, ain't no other way?" asked Hawkins. "All kinds of ways."
"Especially in Alabama," said Amy.
"The papers," I said. "That got him caught."
"No, that is not what happened at all," Corrine said. "It had nothing to do with his papers."
"What then?" I asked.
"He was so close," Corrine said. "So close. He spent all those weeks scouting the shore along the Ohio River until he found the perfect landing. We don't precisely know how he did it, but he found Lydia with her boys and rode down the Tennessee posing as their owner until he was in the free country of Indiana. But then, as I understand it, one of the children got sick, and it became hard on them to continue their travels by night."
"That's how they got picked up," said Hawkins. "White man stopped them for questioning. Thought Bland's story was funny, and took them to a local jail, waiting to see if it was any word on runaways."
"There was," said Amy.
"Bland could have left right there," Hawkins said. "They had nothing on him, but as we've got it from the papers and dispatches of agents in the area, he kept trying to get to Lydia and the kids until they jailed him, too."
"We do not know how he was ultimately killed," Corrine said. "But knowing Bland, he would have continued looking for an escape. And I suspect that the captors realized that the delivery of their Negroes and the claiming of a likely reward would be easier without an agent fixed on getting those Negroes away."
"My lord. My lord," I moaned.
"And damn y'all for sending him," Hawkins said. "Alabama, all kinds of ways to get caught. Into the coffin for some babies?"
I could have told Hawkins all that I had learned. I could have told him about Otha White. I could have told him about Gingerbread. I could have told him about Thena and Kessia. I could have told him how much more there was to the underground, more than math and any angle, more than movement. But Hawkins was grieving in his own way, I knew. I was feeling it more, even now, for the levels of grief and loss now began to unspool. Sophia, Mikaja Bland, Georgie, my mother. I was not even angry about it. By then I knew that this was part of the work, to accept the losses. But I would not accept them all. Chapter 23. Back in Philadelphia, I returned to my routine, alternating between my woodworking and the underground. There was not much time for mourning. It was now September, and the high season of conduction would soon be upon us. There was some concern that Bland had somehow been betrayed. We reviewed our entire system. Codes were changed. Methods of movement revised. Certain agents came under scrutiny. Relations with the Western Underground were never the same again, for it was thought that they might have, witting or not, played some role in Bland's destruction. I saw Kessia quite a bit that month. This was the only good thing to come out of the moment, for it truly was like the discovery of some relative long lost. And at the start of October, Harriet called on me. She suggested a walk through the city. So we headed toward the Schuylkill Docks, then across the South Street Bridge toward the western boundaries of the city. It was a cool, crisp afternoon. The leaves had begun to change and the people to bind themselves up in their long black coats and woolen scarves. Harriet wore a long brown dress, a cotton wrapper around her waist, and a bag across her body. For the first 20 minutes or so, we spoke only of Bland things. Then as we moved farther out and the people began to fall away, our conversation veered toward its true destination.
"How you holding up, friend?"
Harriet asked. "Not so good," I said. "I don't know how anyone holds up against this. Bland was not the first, was he? Not the first agent you lost, I mean. Not for you."
"No, friend, he was not," said Harriet. "And he won't be the last. You had better get that."
"I do," I said.
"No, you don't," she said. "This is war. Soldiers fight in war for all kinds of reasons, but they die because they cannot bear to live in the world as it is. And that right there was the Mukaja Bland I knew. He could not live. Not here, not like this. He put it all on the line, his life, his connections, his sister's heart, because he knew that that is exactly the line on which all the rest of us must live."
We stopped walking here for a moment.
"I know that you don't understand," Harriet said, "but you will adjust yourself to these facts. You will have to. There will be more. Could be you, could be me."
"No, never you," I said, now smiling.
"Someday it will be me," she said. "Just hoping that the only hounds I answer to are held by my lord."
The talk quickly turned to the business at hand.
"So you're with me, friend," said Harriet. "It ain't the coffin, that is true. But Maryland is still Pharaoh's land, and I know what they say about me, but understand that this is never what I say about myself. We all the same when the hound got the scent. That axe swing and any man might be lumber. And with that, all that I have learned shall be nothing, shall be dust upon the long road. You will not find me believing in my own miracles, but in the strictest principles of the underground."
And then she smiled softly and said,
"But there are so many miracles. As when I was told of a man who did not merely conduct but self-resurrected, who hoisted himself out of the ice, a man who, pursued by the hounds, felt a longing for home so fierce that he blinked and he was there."
"That what they say, huh?" I asked.
"That's what they say," she said. "I never told you what happened to me, did I?"
"You don't tell much of nothing about yourself at all. Ain't much for giving out stories, as you said."
"Yeah, I did say that. So we'll wait on that one. Don't matter much either way. What I am asking is that you put more trust in me than your own failings."
We turned around and headed back toward Bainbridge Street, again walking mostly in silence. We got back home, we sat in the front parlor. "So, Maryland," I said.
"Maryland,"
she said. Then she reached into her bag and produced a file of letters.
I need two things. First, a pass, drawn from the shadow of this hand. I need the pass to be for two.
I started scribbling notes.
Then, I need a letter in slave hand, remitted to Jake Jackson of Poplar Neck, Dorchester, Maryland, from his brother Henry Jackson, Beacon Hill, Boston. Give him all the loving tidings of Brother Wood, and do it whatever way should come to you, but note this portion particularly. Tell my brothers to be watchful unto prayer, and when the good old ship of Zion come along, be ready to step on board.
I nodded, still scribbling.
Have that letter off by tomorrow's post. We got to give the thing time to land and make its effect. Then we are on our way. We leave in 2 weeks, one night's journey.
I stopped and gave a puzzled look.
Wait, I said, one night? Ain't enough time to get to Maryland.
She just looked back and smiled.
Nowhere near enough time, I said.
But 2 weeks later, in the dead of night, I walked out of the 9th Street station, down Market Street, where all was asleep, and met Harriet at the docks of the Delaware River. We headed south past the coal depot, past the South Street Pier, where the Red Bank Ferry bobbed in its moorings, until we stood before an array of older, battered piers that were little more than rotted wood groaning and creaking as they swayed in the night-black river. I looked farther down the docks and saw that these shadowy ruins diminished into mere stakes jutting out of the water. The October wind blew up off the river. I looked up and saw that clouds obscured the stars and moon, which so often guided us. Fog rolled up. Harriet stood at the pier, looking out into the night, out through the fog, toward the invisible banks of Camden, but in fact, far past them. She was leaning on her trusty walking stick, the one I'd seen her with on our way to New York. She said,
"For Macaja Bland,"
and then she began to walk on the shattered pier, before us, directly, out into the river. That I followed and did not question tells you exactly how much faith I had placed in Harriet by then. She was our Moses, and I believed, even in my fear, that she would somehow split the sea that now stood before us, and so I walked. I heard Harriet say,
"For all those who have sailed off to the port from which there can be no return."
I heard the wet wood of the pier groan under my weight, but the planks felt sturdy beneath my feet. I looked back, but a fog had encircled us on all sides, and thickened so that I could no longer see the city behind me. I looked forward and saw Harriet still walking out.
"We forgot nothing, you and I," Harriet said. "To forget is to truly slave. To forget is to die."
And at that Harriet stopped in her tracks. There was a light growing now out of the darkness. At first I thought Harriet had lit a lantern, for the light was low and faint, and then I saw that the light was not yellow, but a pale, spectral green, and I saw that this light was not in Harriet's hand, but was in Harriet herself. She turned to me with eyes of the same green fire that had grown up out of the night.
"To remember, friend," she said, "for memory is the chariot, and memory is the way, and memory is bridge from the curse of slavery to the boon of freedom."
That was when I saw that we were in the water. No, not in it, over it. We should have been under it, for I knew that the pier was gone and there was no longer anything of this world beneath our feet. The Delaware River is deep enough for a steamer to come into harbor, but the water barely lapped against my boots.
"Stay with me, friend," Harriet said. "No exertions needed. It's just like dancing. Stay with the sound, stay with the story, and you will be fine. And the story is, as I have said, offered up for all those given over to the maw of the demon. We've seen it all our lives, yes, we have. Starts when you're young, with but the barest sense of the world, but mayhaps even then you got some sense that it is wrong. I know I did."
What happened then was a kind of communion. A chain of memory extending between the two of us that carried more than any words I can now offer you here, because the chain was ground into some deep and locked away place, where my Aunt Emma lived, where my mother lived, where a great power lived. The chain extended into the selfsame place in Harriet, where all of those lost ones had taken up their vigil. And then I looked out and saw them, phantoms, flittering like that baleful day out on the River Goose, and I knew exactly what the phantoms were and what they meant to Harriet. So when I saw the boy off to the side of us, out in the mist, wrapped in spectral green, no older than 12, I knew that his name was Abe, and I knew that he was among those gone Natchez way, sent across the river with no name. And now I could hear Harriet's voice again in that deep place where the chain was anchored and rooted.
"You are not acquainted with this Abe," she said, "but by the light of this conduction you shall know him right well. I regret that he will not be joining us on the way back. It is regrets of Abe that sent me to the underground."
Now the light of Harriet opened with some brightness, and I saw a path before us across the water that was not water. There was no dock in the distance, but in and out of the darkness I saw the phantoms of Harriet's memory, dancing about as they would have been in that time when they were known to her. And as we approached and passed each one, the phantoms fell away.
"You know me well, friend," she said. "I was made under the lash. I was only 7 when Master Brodus sent me trapping varmints in the swamps. I might like to lose a limb out there. But I come back whole, out the cage, not the jungle. When I was 9, they called me up to the big house and I was given the entirety of the parlor's care. My errors were many. My mistress beat me every day with a rope. I began to think that this was God's plan, that I really was the wretch they made me out to be, and deserved no more than the abuses I received. Now, for all my humiliations, the fact of it is that there were some corners of hell to which I, thankfully, received no invitation. I speak now of the crossing of the Nameless, of the long walk to Natchez, the mournful march to Baton Rouge. I saw it all, friend. Why, my uncle Hark lost half an arm just thinking of the Nameless, just watching them white men watch him a little too closely. So one morning he got up, and thinking how hard it'd be to sell a cripple, raised his axe with one hand and gave the other hand over to the Lord. I might be lame, Hark say, but I shall not be parted. Hark was uncommon. Most just took the walk, leaving in their wake wailing wives, broken husbands, and orphans. And then there was our boy, Abe, whose wide, wondrous face I see before me right now, easy as I did in that other life. A well-mannered boy who done only as he was told. His mama died in the birthing, and his daddy was long sold away. Whatever pains he felt over these partings, he never shared. He spoke only as a child should, when induced by elder folk, and these elders, knowing his pain, however hidden, was soft upon him. But for those who were hard, for those who worshipped the 7 and 9, Abe was a caution. I tell you, friend, that boy could not be held, would have made a hell of an agent, for he ran like he had the lungs of a lion. The moment Master Brodus even thought of correction, that boy would fly. Sometimes the head man would call us up to help hold him. We might make some motion as such, but in our hearts, we were with Abe. You know what it is. The task must take their victories as they come. And if you saw Abe as we did, blazing through the wheat field, hurtling through the high corn, you would have seen our deepest unspeaking freedom, friend, freedom. In those moments running, he was free, unweighted by the partings, unbroken by the 7 and 9. And watching him is how I got my first taste of conduction, of the great power in even the smallest of escapes.
Harriet paused here for some moments, and we moved again in silence. I was gripped by her telling, and could see the events of her narrative open up before me. And so full was the brilliance beaming out from her that all features of our path stood in green relief.
I stood outside the town emporium, minding my own. And like lightning, I seen young Abe streak by. He bounded a bench, shot under a wagon, got himself proper, and flew on. And then right behind him, I seen old Galloway stumbling over himself, panting with every trot. Galloway called out to a Tascan man, "You there, boy? Come bind this fellow." They cornered Abe, but might as well have cornered the air. He dashed out and slid right under Galloway's legs, easy as the boat under the bridge, and Galloway cried out, cursing his very hands. I should have been going on then, but I was fixed on the story now playing out before me. And the longer it went, the more men came, till I seen the task, the low, and Galloway all bent over, panting, heads bent over in their humiliation. Now, Galloway would like to give the thing up, but there was a crowd now, and so his pride kept him going. Can't no slaver have his niggers in defiance. So Galloway gathered himself and bounded on. I watched them dance a little more, and then Abe turned toward me. My particular feelings upon slavery were not yet whole. Surely I would like to be a gal working on her own time. But I was young. I had no religion but felt Abe in flight to be my own jubilee. So Abe darted my way. And then I heard Galloway call to me as he called to all the others, "Bind that boy!" I could not. I would not. I was nobody's head man. And if I was, I should know better than to make my marbles upon the taking of a boy like Abe. He cut away, ran, and then cut back toward me again. And out of his own unthinking frustration, Galloway grabbed a weight and hurled it at Abe. Don't know what he was thinking, for Abe had eyes in the back of his head. No such luck upon young Harriet.
By now Harriet burned with the brilliance of 20 lanterns, and the pale green extended out into a full white. There was no water. I could not feel my legs, I could not truly feel any part of me. I was now merely a presence, an essence, following a voice.
The weight sailed right past Abe and caught me in the head, crashed through my skull, and then the Lord's long night came all over me. I did not wake in Dorchester, but in some other time. I saw Abe racing across the land, and his foot tracks set the trees to fire. The forest burned to cinder. The ash fell to the ground, and then the ash rose with the wind until it formed itself into a whole company of black men in blue, black men with rifles upon their shoulders. And I was there with them, Hiram. And we were a multitude. In the eyes of this army assembled before me, I beheld the humiliations of slavery burning like fire. And each of these men had the face of young Abe. I stood upon a high bluff, soldiers arrayed around me. Below we saw the great range of our shackled country, its crops rooted in flesh and watered with blood. And a song rose up among these men, this legion of Abes, as they stood in ranks, and the song was that old feeling put to him. And on my side we fell down upon this sinful country, and our battle cry was as mighty as a great river conducted through a high and narrow valley. I awoke. I saw my mama crying. I had been down under for months. All thought me lost. None knew that I had been found. All that year, my body recovered. Whole weeks would pass, and I would not speak. But there were words aplenty in my head. And I knew at that young age that someday the season of running would pass, that we would take our victories as we wanted, not as they were given, and we would fall upon this country in the spirit of all those taken over the nameless. And we would scourge this Natchez, and we would burn this Baton Rouge.
The light of Harriet began to dim now, gradually, as it had arisen, and I felt my body slowly coming back to me, my thumping heart, my heaving lungs, my hands, my legs, my feet, all now landing not on water, but solid ground.
Young Abe, I have not forgotten you. Before undergrounds and conductions, before agents and orphans, before Makaja Bland, when I was but a girl, You gave me the first feeling of what it might mean to be free. I heard they captured you by Hampton's Mark, not so far from Elias Creek. They say you were at last worn down, but still on all it took a town to tackle you. I do not believe them. All who have seen you know the truth. You might be lamed, but you shall never be parted.
Now the light had fallen back to palest green. My eyes were restored. I looked out. The docks, the river, the piers were all gone. And looking up, I saw, where there had once been clouds, a clear sky and the North Star blinking out. I was on an outcropping with a small bank of woods behind us and a large empty field in front and below. I looked back along the path to see from where we had come, but there was nothing but the woods. I heard Harriet moan, and I saw she was leaning on her walking stick. With a trembling voice, she said,
"Horse, saddle."
She took a step back and tumbled backward to the ground. I ran to her and held up her head. Her eyes rolled back and she moaned softly. That was when I heard the horn. I laid Harriet softly upon the ground and turned and looked out across the field, and I saw them there, if only as shadows, tasking folk making their way out. And I knew we were not in Philadelphia anymore. A door had opened. The land had folded like fabric. Conduction. 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 Chapter 24. I was in new country. The trees, the smells, the birds. And just then I saw the sun breaking, and all of it coming alive. I could not take to the roads. Ryland would be watching. And two, there were tasking folks of uncertain loyalties who might want to claim the grand bounty that forever hung over the head of Moses. I stood there for a moment, looking down from the outcropping. The sun was just beginning to blow yellow over the horizon. I gathered up Harriet and slung her gently as I could over one shoulder. Then I squatted down and took her walking stick in hand. I pushed back into the woods slowly but deliberately, clearing the branches and the brambles with the stick, then walking into the space I'd opened. After an hour of this, with some intermittent rest, I spotted a dry gully beneath some shrubbery. I saw that there was just enough space here to lay Harriet, but not enough for me. Her safety was uppermost. I could be left to chance. I pushed deeper into the woods, thinking that should I be taken, I would like to be taken alone. At nightfall, I would return for Harriet, who I hoped would have roused herself by then. In the early afternoon, I heard woodsmen from a nearby timber camp come out for scouting. I was perfectly still, which was nothing when measured next to the time I'd spent confined in that Virginia burial pit. Later, I saw two low whites and their hounds out for hunting. But I had sprinkled graveyard dust all around, which I knew would conceal my trail. I saw a group of children, some quality, some tasked, out at play, and wondered if they might take my hiding place for their own. But they scooted on. And then, after the longest day I had ever lived, I rejoiced as the shade of night drew over the earth. The moon flew up high, and its rise was carried as much in the firmament as in my nervous heart. I walked back to the gully, and pulling away the brush, I saw Harriet still lying there, as I left her, walking stick across her chest like a pharaoh entombed. I reached to touch her face, as she had so often touched mine. It was cold to the touch. I looked down and saw her lungs heaving strong, and when I found her face again, I saw that her eyes were open. She smiled and said,
"Evening, friend."
She was up in minutes. It was as if the whole thing was but a nap. We walked for some time, following a dirt road, but keeping ourselves to the woods, so we would see any patrol long before it was upon us.
"My apologies, friend. I thought I had enough spirit to make it without one of those bouts," she said. "The jump is done by the power of the story. It pulls from our particular histories, from all of our loves and all of our losses. All of that feeling is called up, and on the strength of our remembrances, we are moved. Sometimes it takes more than other times, and on those former times, well, you've seen what happened. I had made this jump so many times before, though, no idea why this one socked me so.
We walked, and the woods opened into a clearing where men from the timber camps had been at work. Across the field I saw a cabin, and through a window, the flickering of a hearth fire.
"That there's our place," she said, "but I suppose you must have some questions. There will not be much time after this, so I suggest you ask now."
We sat on a pair of stumps. The night was cool, a slight wind blew out from the forest and across the fields. On the street, we lived in a world of stories and tales, of hoodoo and professed conjuration, of prohibitions. No hogs slaughtered under moonlight, the floor never walked with one shoe. I did not believe in that world. Even as I knew what had happened to me, how I had come to Thena, how I had come out of the goose, I thought the whole explicable, comprehensible, through books. And maybe it is all explicable, and maybe this is that book. But nevertheless, when I was conducted, I underwent a drastic revision of the world around me, and what wonders and powers it held. My grandmother was a pure-blood African. "Went by the name of Santi Bess," I said. It was said that this Bess could unwind an African tale with such effect that sometimes a first frost would feel like a prairie heat. Harriet, seated upon the stump, said nothing. And Bess's gift for stories was so prized that the quality would bring her up during their socials, and she would put her stories to songs and rhythms that they had never heard. They were amused by her and would toss coins. Bess would smile and scrape the coins into her apron. She never kept them. She gave them to the children in the quarters. She claimed to have no need, and I think I now know why. As the story goes, Bess came to my mama one night and told her that she must walk to a place where mama could not follow. They were born to two different worlds, she told her. Mama's was here, but my grandmother's was far gone. And now Bess must tell a story, the oldest story she knew, one that would turn back time itself and journey her back to that place where her fathers were buried in honor and her mothers gathered their own corn. That night Bess walked down to the river in the middle of winter and disappeared. And Bess ain't disappear alone. That same night, 48 of the tasked walked off their plantation to never be seen again. And every one of them was purebloods, just like Santi Bess. I have never known how to feel about this story, Harriet. My mama was left out of connection. Her father was sold off. Then she was sold off, too. I thought I was done with all of that. I can barely see her face, for I have no memory of her now. But that story, and this Santi Bess, I trailed off, shrinking back from the words forming in my throat. I turned to Harriet, stunned. "How have you done this?"
"Sounds as if you already know, friend," said Harriet. "Imagine the islands in a great river, and imagine the normal folks must swim from island to island. Imagine that is their only method. But you, friend, you are different, because you, unlike the others, can see a bridge across that river, many bridges even, connecting all the islands, many bridges, each one made of a different story. And you cannot just see the bridges. You can walk across, drive across, conduct across with passengers in tow, sure as an engineer conduct a train. That is conduction. The many bridges. The many stories. The way over the river. It was a known practice among the older ones. And I have heard tell that even on the slave ship, folk leaped to the waves and were conducted back to their old African home."
Harriet sighed, shook her head, and said,
"But we are here now, and we have forgotten the old songs and lost so many of our stories."
"There's so much," I said, "so much I can't remember."
"Seems to me you remember quite a bit," Harriet said.
"I do. Everything, every little small bit. But there is a gash in the thing, a gash in me, a gash where my mother should be. When I look back, I can see my childhood playing out like a stage show right here in front of me, but the main player is Fog.
Huh,
she said. Then she leaned on her stick and stood.
Ever consider you don't really want to see?
No, I said, not really. I feel that it is the opposite, in fact. Like I am really straining to see. Harriet nodded and then handed me the walking stick. I turned it in my hand, looking at the glyphs on each side.
Those markings won't mean nothing to you. It is written in the language that only I hear. And what is important is not the markings, but the stick itself. Stripped from the sweet gum tree. Reminds me of them days when they put me out to the timbers. Worst days of my life. But they was the days that made me. I think about them sometimes, think about all that happened out there, and I like to break down and cry. It is a painful thing, what they have done to us. And there is a part of me that would like to forget, but when I grip that branch of sweet gum, I cannot help but remember. I can't say what done happened to you, Hiram. But if I were to venture a guess, I would say that there is some part of you that wants to forget, that is trying with all its might to forget. And what you need is something outside of yourself, something beyond you, a lever to unlock that thing you done shut away. Only you know what that thing might be, but I think if you can find that lever, then you can find your mother. And when you find your mother, you will find that bridge.
That how it worked for you? You put your hands on that sweet gum branch and everything was there?
No, that's not how it worked. But I am not like you. Kessia told me some of it. We both might have tasked, but we ain't tasked the same. See, when I came up from that deep sleep, I ain't just remember. I heard colors. I saw songs. I felt all the various odors of the world. Voices assaulted me from all over, and remembrances old as ancestors did not dim, but burned bright as torches. I would watch them play out before me, and everywhere I walked was just like you said, a whole stage of memories was with me. They used to say I was touched. So I learned to regulate the power, to summon some voices and then make others diminish. Sometimes they were too strong and they would tumble me down, just as they did last night. But when I rose after, I rose upon different earth. It was the bridge, Hiram, she said.
Conjured up, I asked.
No, she said. The story is always real. It's not made by me, it is made by the people. And the story is fit to certain points, like the base of a bridge, which cannot be altered by me, nor Santi, nor you.
I don't know, I said. Feels chancy to me, like this thing can take me at any point, in the stables, on an actual bridge, in a field, anywhere.
Was it a trough in that stable? She asked.
Sure was, I said. Filled with water, felt like it sucked me right in.
Bet it did, she said. Nothing chancy about any of that.
I ain't understanding.
Don't you see it, friend? You were standing at the ramp of the bridge. In every one of those stories, Santi into the river, you out of the goose, us over the pier.
I sat there dumb. I still wasn't getting it. And at that, Harriet laughed.
Water, Hiram. Water. Conduction got to have water.
My mouth must have dropped because Harriet started laughing even harder. And she had a right to laugh. It seemed so obvious now. Every time I'd felt the pull of the thing, felt the river of conduction rushing along from the water trough in the stables to the goose that pulled Maynard and me off the bridge to the Schuylkill near Bland's home, there had always been water within reach. And now I thought of all of Corrine's absurd efforts to access the power, and never once had we noted that element that now seemed most obvious. Why didn't you use it for Lydia? I asked. We were now walking toward the cabin.
"Because to tell a man a story, you got to know how it ends," said Harriet. "I never been to Alabama. Can't jump to an end I ain't never seen. And even knowing beginning and end, I have to know something of who I'm conducting in order to bring 'em along. Don't usually have that luxury, which is why my normal means are as any other agent. This time, though, it's folks I know."
We walked over to the cottage and found those people. The door opened as we approached, and warmth breathed out. It was now deep into the night, but inside the cabin, everything teemed. We were greeted by a motley group of four men, all of them in tasking clothes. Two of these men had an aspect similar enough to Harriet that I knew they were kin. A third tended the fire that I'd seen burning through the window. My eyes lingered on the fourth, sensing something amiss, and then I realized that this one was a woman with her head nearly totally shorn. I thought of the two white women at the convention who preached quality in every sphere, but I knew that this was a scheme of a different sort.
"Hiram, this is Chase Piers," Harriet said, gesturing toward the man tending the fire. "He is our host, and we are thankful for his part in this."
Then, smiling at the other two men, whom I took to be kin, she said,
"No such kind words for these two rascals."
Then she hugged them both, and they all laughed. Harriet said,
"These are my brothers Ben and Henry. Finally got some steel in these boys. Took them long enough, but I guess if Henry had not stayed down this way, he never would have met his wife."
And now Harriet went over to the woman whose hair was shorn, rubbed the round egg of her head, and laughed.
"Every whit of this is your making," the woman said, smiling but annoyed. "Why, I knows the Lord must be carrying us up out the coffin, for he would not have a girl give away a blossom of hair such as mine for still another chain."
"Worked, didn't it?" said Harriet.
The girl nodded and smiled, less annoyed.
"This is Jane," Harriet said. "She's Henry's wife."
Jane now smiled at me. The absence of her hair put the focus on her striking face, the sharp angles of her cheeks, her small eyes and large ears. And there was a boisterous faith in her, a feeling shared among all who gathered before the hearth. By then I had been party to enough rescues to know that this was not normal. Fear was normal. Whispers were normal. But this group laughed like they were already north. It was nothing like I'd seen in Virginia or even among those who'd come through the Philadelphia station. The difference was Harriet, who by way of conduction, by weaving of legend, was now her own one-woman war against the task, and in particular against the county that had her so. And seeing this, even after having seen conduction, I decided that the stories really must be true. Harriet really had pulled the pistol on the coward. She really had conducted across a river in winter. The whip really had melted in the overseer's hand. She was the only agent never to fail at a single rescue, never to lose a passenger on the rail. And though that is the story, it was known even then among those huddling in the warmth of that cabin. For when they spoke of their departure, they spoke of it as divine right. Here they were on the cusp of a realized prophecy, and before them was their prophet Moses, filling them up with certainty. Harriet now unspooled the plan.
"It is the tradition that a rescue be kept simple and small, and not just the tradition, but wisdom," she said. "But you are all known to me, every one, and I have agreed to your terms, and you have agreed to mine, which are simple. None shall turn back."
I felt in this moment, perhaps more than in the conduction itself, that all the sobriquets that attended Harriet were earned. Her manner, calm and steely, would have been enough. But it was the effect she had on the others. None spoke. It seemed as though the night itself froze, and there was only Harriet holding our attention. And when she offered her edict, "None shall turn back," it didn't fill us with fear, for it did not seem a threat, but prophecy.
"Jane and Henry, you shall remain here at Chase's place. Keep indoors until tomorrow night, on account of it being Sunday. Should be some time before they figure you two done picked up and left. Ben, I know you won't be tasking, but do me a favor and make yourself seen just in case. We don't want old Brodus and his people seeing the threads until the web is all around them. About this time tomorrow night, we shall meet at Daddy's place, rest a taste, and then we are gone.
She paused, drew herself back, and then stood with the aid of her walking stick.
Now, here we arrive upon the complication. Hiram, there is one who ain't among us. My brother Robert has a baby coming, and would not like to go at all but for the fact that Brodus is ready to put him on the auction block. Robert got to run, but he insisted that he remain with his wife until the last second he could. It was not my wish to leave the thing as so, but family gets a hold of your heart and starts to twisting, and, well, what comes of that often is not wise. But I have agreed only on the notion that he be kept in the dark as to the whole of our plans. I'll tell him like I'm telling the rest of you when I get him under my eyes. So, Robert must be gotten, and you,